This is Audible.
Brought to you by Penguin.
We Who Wrestle with God, Perceptions of the Divine, by Jordan B. Peterson. Read by Jordan B. Peterson. To my recently deceased mother, Beverly Ann Peterson, who, like all of us, wrestled with God, she more happily than not. Carrion comfort. Not, I will not, carrion comfort, despair, not feast on thee, not untwist, slack they may be, these last strands of man in me, or, most weary, cry, I can no more. I can something, hope, wish day come, not choose not to be. But O thou terrible, why wouldst thou rude on me, thy ring-world right foot rock? Lay a lion limb against me, scan with darksome devouring eyes my bruised bones, and fan, oh, in turns of tempest, me heaped there, me frantic to avoid thee and flee. Why? That my chaff might fly, my grain lie sheer and clear? Nay, in all that toil, that coil, since seems I kissed the rod, hand rather, my heart, lo, lapped strength, stole joy, would laugh, cheer? Cheer whom, though? The hero whose heaven-handling flung me, foot trod me, or me that fought him? Oh, which one? Is it each one? That night, that year of now done darkness, I, wretch, lay wrestling with my God, my God. Earlier drafts of the final line. Of darkness done that I, wretch, wrestled, I wrung with God. Now done, I know that I, wretch, wrestled, I wrung with God. Done now, I know that I, wretch, wrestled, I wrung with God. Of darkness now done with, I, wretch, in wrestle wrung. Gerald Manley Hopkins, 1885. The history of supreme beings, whose structure is celestial, is of the utmost importance for an understanding of the religious history of humanity as a whole. We cannot even consider writing that history here in a few pages, but we must at least refer to a fact that to us seems primary. Celestially structured supreme beings tend to disappear from the practice of religion, from cult. They depart from among men, withdraw to the sky, and become remote, inactive gods, dei otiosi. In short, it may be said of these gods that after creating the cosmos, life, and man, they feel a sort of fatigue, as if the immense enterprise of the creation had exhausted their resources. So, they withdraw to the sky. Mircea Eliade, The Sacred and the Profane, 1959.
Foreshadowing, the still small voice. We begin our journey, our wrestling with God, with the consideration of a singular tale, that of the prophet Elijah, also known as Elias, recounted in the Old Testament books of 1 and 2 Kings. His story is one of many in the biblical corpus that might and will be so contemplated, chosen for introductory purposes, because it provides a surprising and sophisticated characterization of the divine in a brief yet highly instructive manner. Before we begin our exposition, however, we might first well ask, why devote so much, or even any time and effort, to the analysis of any story, let alone one so ancient, forsaken, and even obscure? There are many reasons, but one has become paramount, perhaps, in recent decades. Something truly revolutionary is afoot. something that has riven the world. Although the cause of such division, manifesting itself, for example, in the form of the culture war obsessing the West, has not yet risen widely to consciousness. It is the near simultaneous discovery by literary critics, researchers into robotics and artificial intelligence, cognitive scientists, and neuropsychologists alike, that we do and even must perceive reality through a story. Or more accurately, their discovery that a story is a portrayal of the structure through which we perceive reality. The Enlightenment, which so transformed the world technically, scientifically, philosophically, and theologically, was predicated on the belief that rationality or empiricism or some amalgam of both had permanently supplanted the religious, even the superstitious, and that we could henceforth be guided by the facts alone. This supposition turned out to be wrong, even by the standards established by that very Enlightenment, and seriously so. Thus, the current era of our understanding of the world is ending, and something new is striving to be born. This will either be the descent of the world into the nihilism, hedonism, and striving for power that has always characterized the end of the world, or, as the poet T.S. Eliot had it, a new arrival where we started, knowing the place for the first time. We have always and will always live in a story. It is something truly new that we now know not only that we do so, but why we do and must. There is more. We can now also understand the necessary true guiding story and its dread alternatives much more explicitly and consciously than we have managed in the past, and can use that understanding to provide us with the meaning that sustains and to deliver us from evil, to undergird and buttress our determination to do good in the world rather than ill. The potentially revolutionary significance of this more specific realization can also hardly be overstated. We have discovered that the facts alone cannot provide direction or meaning. They cannot structure perception or determine action, cannot quell anxiety, provide hope, or unite psychologically and socially. This is not least because there are simply too many facts, one per phenomenon, perhaps, or even one for every conceivable combination of phenomena. We can only drown in such an infinite plethora. We have neither the attentional resources nor the time and energy to contemplate even a fraction of the sense data, so-called, that constantly presents itself to us, and we certainly cannot even begin to compute the significance of the exponentially expanding number of pathways that emerge in consequence of any single action we might undertake. This is an intractable problem, something that philosopher Daniel C. Dennett famously characterized as a new, deep, epistemological problem. There are a near infinite number of ways to categorize, hence to perceive, a finite number of objects. We do not and cannot attend with equal devotion to everything occurring always and everywhere around us. Instead, with every glance, we prioritize the facts. In doing so, we attend to very little and ignore much. We do so in keeping with our aim. We do so to gain what we need and want. But what is that? It is that fundamental question that the analysis of the remarkable story of Elijah will help us begin to answer. The great prophet in question lived in the time of King Ahab and his wife Jezebel in the 9th century BC. Though his story is a brief one, Elijah is notable among the prophets for two reasons: his strange manner of death and his much later appearance alongside Moses and Jesus of Nazareth at the pinnacle of Mount Tabor during the so-called Transfiguration, Matthew 17, 1-9, Mark 9, 2-8, Luke 9, 28-37. That term, Transfiguration, was employed by the Latin translators of the original Greek text, who referred to that event with the word metamorpho, with its connotations of the qualitative transformation of caterpillar into butterfly. Human beings grow and develop as they mature, assuming they mature, in a manner nearly as radical as that of the winged insect. As the Apostle Paul notes in 1 Corinthians 11-13, "When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things." It is thus far from irrelevant that the Greek word psyche, the root from which the term psychology is derived, the signifier for the human spirit or soul, literally meant butterfly. Profound as that linkage is between soul and butterfly, it is not the only reason for the comparison. Butterflies are also capable of astonishing feats of navigation. This is something at least near miraculous, given their fragility and hypothetically limited intelligence. In this navigational capacity, and perhaps in their brevity of life and restrictions, they are similar to human beings who have traveled from their African point of origin to every corner of the planet, no matter how distant and inhospitable. The gossamer-winged insects are also beautiful, exceptionally symmetrical, and remarkable in their capability to perceive in relationship to that beauty and symmetry and select mates accordingly. They can detect deviations from both characteristics with stunning accuracy. This reveals a high capacity for judgment in relationship to the ideal, another ability that the perfectly crafted insect shares with the human psyche. Why is all this relevant to our account of the prophet Elijah and to the understanding of life? Because his manner of death and his later reappearance in the company of the transfigured Christ are both representative or symbolic of the psyche's capacity for qualitative and revolutionary transmutation. We are informed in Kings 2:2 that Elijah is taken up bodily into heaven while still alive, a privilege that the Old Testament awards only to him and the prophet Enoch, Genesis 5:24. It is, of course, part and parcel of Christian tradition that Jesus rises in a similar manner after his resurrection, Luke 24:50-53, Acts 1:9-11. Much of Christendom also accepts the doctrine of the Assumption of Mary, the taking up of her body and soul into heaven after her death. But that is the extent of such phenomena. Ascension to the divine realm marks the presence of someone very notable indeed. At the time of Elijah's passing, he is in the company of Elisha, his disciple and successor. They are traveling from Gilgal to Bethel, both places of deep biblical import. Gilgal is, for example, the place where the Israelites set up a memorial to God to commemorate safe passage over the River Jordan to the Promised Land, Joshua 4:19-24. Bethel, for its part, means house of God. It first appears in Genesis 28:10-22, as the place where Jacob dreams of an upward-reaching ladder to heaven, with angels intermediaries between the divine and man, descending and ascending upon it. In this dream, God reaffirms to Jacob the covenant he had made with Abraham and Isaac, promising him numerous offspring, land, and divine protection. Any story that features its heroes moving from a place of momentous occurrence to another of equivalent or even greater consequence is an account of the idea of significant journey itself, a description of a path of life being realized in the optimally adventurous and meaningful manner. It is in keeping with this that Elijah's last and greatest adventure occurs at or near Bethel, the site of the vision of Jacob's ladder. Elijah is with him. And it came to pass, when they were gone over, that Elijah said unto Elisha, "Ask what I shall do for thee before I be taken away from thee." And Elisha said, "I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me." And he said, "Thou hast asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if thou see me when I am taken from thee, it shall be so unto thee. But if not, it shall not be so." And it came to pass, as they still went on and talked, that behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and parted them both asunder. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it, and he cried, my father, the chariot of Israel, and the horsemen thereof." And he saw him no more. And he took hold of his own clothes and rent them in two pieces. 2 Kings 2:9-12. In this manner, Elijah is delivered into the kingdom of God, in the same manner that the great seeker after beauty and navigator of the insect world takes wing into the heavens after its metamorphosis. This rise into the realm of the divine on the part of the prophet sets the stage for his later reappearance with Jesus on the pinnacle of Mount Tabor. And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them up into a high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elias talking with him. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us make here 3 tabernacles, one for thee, and one for Moses, and one for Elias." While he yet spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him." And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their face and were sore afraid. 17:1-6. A similarly awe-inducing transformation occurs in the accounts of Moses. And it came to pass when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the 2 tables of testimony in Moses' hand, when he came down from the mount, that Moses wist not that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. And when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come nigh him. 34:29-30. This shining is the co-occurrence of the ultimate up, so to speak, with what is normally merely human, an indication of the descent of the divine to the profane, or the ascent of the ladder upward. It therefore makes perfect sense, symbolically speaking, that such radical transmutations of psyche or transformations of character take place on mountaintops. The summit of the holy mountain is the mythical place where heaven and earth touch, where the merely material meets the transcendent and divine. Further, life is well and accurately portrayed as a series of uphill journeys. For pessimists, that is the dread fate of Sisyphus, doomed to roll a rock up a mountain to the peak, only to have it roll back down. So the process must be endlessly repeated. A more optimistic observer might see instead endless opportunities for personal transformation. When we have climbed a new mountain and reached the pinnacle, that is, attained our aim, we have brought something successfully to an end, fulfilled a proximal vision, and become more than we were. When we have reached the top, at least of our present climb, we can also see everything laid out in front of us, including the next challenge, the next possibility for play, maturation, and growth, the next calling for transformational sacrifice. The continually ascending progress represented by a series of uphill climbs, each with its peak experience, is a variant of the path of ascension represented by Jacob's ladder, the spiraling rise into the heavens toward the kingdom of God, with God himself beckoning at the high point, on the apex of the highest conceivable mount. There is much more to the story of Elijah than his remarkable manner of death and his final transformation. The great prophet lived in the time of the divided kingdom of Israel and Judah. At that point, the people of Israel labored under the rule of King Ahab, who turned them to the worship of gods other than Yahweh, the traditional deity of Abraham, Isaac, and the chosen people. This perversion of aim occurred as a direct consequence of Ahab's marriage to Jezebel, a wealthy, privileged princess of Phoenicia, one who brought her false gods in tow in the aftermath of her wedding. Baal, her god of choice, was a Phoenician Canaanite, deity of nature, responsible for fertility, rain, thunder, lightning, and dew. Ahab's new wife, who was nothing if not direct, killed most of the prophets of Yahweh during her attempts to establish Baal's primacy. It is said that Jezebel's husband, fully under her sway, did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel that were before him. 1 Kings 16:33. Elijah warns the king against his weakness and idolatry, telling him that the consequences of his misguided rule will be years of drought so severe that even the dew will cease to appear. As Baal was the god deemed directly responsible for the life-giving rain, Elijah's predicted drought clearly undermined the authority of the god and his priests, as well as the people's trust in Ahab, their king, and Jezebel. The literary motif of the parched kingdom employed in this narrative fragment is a stably meaningful symbolic trope. This was illustrated, for example, in the Disney animated masterpiece, The Lion King. When Scar, the evil brother of the rightful king, deposes Mufasa, true king of Pride Rock, he banishes his son, Simba, to the periphery of the kingdom. Consequently, the rain ceases to fall, and the animals the lions hunt and depend on vanish. When Simba retakes the throne, the rain returns. The fairy tale, The Water of Life, by the Brothers Grimm, elaborates on this theme, presenting it as the adventure of a younger brother charged with bringing the water that revitalizes to his dying father. Something similar is indicated in the book of Exodus, with its contrast between the stone-like rigidity of the intransigent Pharaoh and the dynamic mastery of water characteristic of Moses. When the wrong principle is established as supreme, when a false king is set upon the throne or an impious ethos prevails, the people quickly find themselves deprived of the very water of life. More deeply, however, a kingdom oriented around the wrong pole, that worships the wrong gods, so to speak, suffers psychologically or spiritually. After declaring the drought and retiring to the desert, where he is initially fed by ravens and drinks from a brook, the prophet's own stores dry up. God directs Elijah forthwith to a widow in the town of Zarephath. He finds her by a well and asks for water and bread. She responds, "As the Lord thy God liveth, I have not a cake, but an handful of meal in a barrel, and a little oil in a cruse. And behold, I am gathering two sticks, that I may go in and dress it for me and my son, that we may eat it and die." 1 Kings 17:12. Elijah reassures her, saying that God will not allow privation into her house. "For thus saith the Lord God of Israel, the barrel of meal shall not waste, neither shall the cruse of oil fail, until the day that the Lord sendeth rain upon the earth." 1 Kings 17:14. It may seem strange that an emissary of God finds it necessary to turn to an impoverished widow for sustenance. But the biblical accounts are subtle and sophisticated. Here, the story of Elijah stresses first the importance even of the lowly, the widow in this instance. Second, the necessity of moral orientation, even under conditions of privation. The widow's willingness to provide hospitality, an obligation that will resurface in our investigations. And third, the absolute dependence of abundance upon proper moral orientation on the part of all, regardless of their status. The undue and manipulative influence the wife of the weak king brings to bear on her feckless and faithless husband threatens the integrity of the state itself. In part, she represents the oft-dangerous attraction of the strange ideas and customs that can invade and permeate a society under the guise of the creative, sophisticated, and new. Before the objection arises, the authors of the biblical stories were inexcusably prejudiced, even xenophobic. It is right to consider Old Testament figures such as Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, who figures so importantly in the book of Exodus, see particularly 18:17-23, Rahab, a courageous and faithful prostitute from Jericho, Joshua 2, and Naaman, 2 Kings 5, whose humility and faith allowed for his healing at the hands of Elijah. These are all individuals who, despite or even because of their foreignness, perceive with an untrammeled eye and conduct themselves morally, and they therefore play a corrective role when the Israelites corrupt themselves. Sometimes the new parasitizes and poisons, and sometimes it restores and renews. Wisdom is, not least, the ability to discriminate help from hindrance in such cases. The poor but good woman who has lost her husband is subtly presented as desirable opposite to the arrogant and dangerous Queen Jezebel. Why? For most of human history, widowhood was a dire state of affairs, particularly when the women so afflicted had dependent children. In the biblical corpus, the figure of the widow is therefore often used to represent vulnerability, powerlessness, and existence on the social and economic fringe. Her miserable state of affairs might well be regarded as an ever-present form of cosmic injustice. It is for this reason, as well as for the moral edification of his people, that the Spirit of God calls on the Israelites to redress this iniquity, to forego the temptations of narrow self-centeredness and greed, and to leave something for the dispossessed. And when ye reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not wholly reap the corners of thy field, neither shalt thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest, and thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shalt thou gather every grape of thy vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and stranger. I am the Lord, your God. Leviticus 19:9-10. This principle is elaborated in the book of Deuteronomy, along with an additional point. At some stage in life, each and every individual will depend on others. Therefore, a properly structured psyche and society are arranged so that this inevitable dependence meets with necessary care and concern. There is no sense in establishing a society that fails to care for the people who compose it at every stage of their development, from vulnerable to able, productive, and generous. When thou gatherest the grapes of thy vineyard, thou shalt not glean it afterward. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command thee to do this thing. Deuteronomy 24:21-22. The widow who is generous despite her poverty embodies the pattern of reciprocal sacrificial conduct and mutual aid that characterizes a mature, reliable individual and a peaceful and productive state alike. She stands in the starkest contrast to the privileged queen whose self-absorption threatens the psyche and community. As the story of Elijah continues, the idea that the psychological and social hierarchy of values must organize itself under the appropriate ruler, or, more abstractly, the proper principle, is driven further home. The prophet leaves Zarephath and sets up what might be regarded in colloquial terms as the showdown at Mount Carmel. He convinces the head of Ahab's palace, Obadiah, to gather all the prophets of Baal, as well as the people of Israel, at the mountain's foot. Two sacrificial altars are prepared, one for Baal under the control of his prophets, the other for Yahweh under the dominion of Elijah. Each god is called on to ignite the altar fire that will consume the sacrifice. Baal's prophets pray for hours to no avail. Elijah soaks his altar with water three times, just to drive his point home, and then requests Yahweh's intercession. A fire immediately descends from heaven and immolates the sacrifice and even the altar itself. Yahweh's supremacy is thus established. The prophets of Baal are executed, and an abundance of rain, 1 Kings 18:41, immediately returns. There can be no wealth in the absence of a true moral order. Under the guidance of the appropriate animating spirit, privation can be made a distant memory. None too happy, Jezebel directs her wrath at Elijah. The hapless prophet therefore flees deep into the barren wilderness. He takes shelter in a cave where God speaks to him. 1 Kings 19. The receipt of revelation in a solitary place is a common storytelling trope. Internal voices and imaginative experience become more likely under conditions of isolation when external verbal communication is minimized, and in darkness and silence where external sensory stimuli are dramatically reduced. This increases the likelihood of revelatory experience, for better or worse. At a deeper level, this may be because the neurological systems of the right hemisphere, which, at least in right-handed people, are more associated with unconscious and implicit thought and action, can take control of verbal and imagistic experience when they are not drowned out or otherwise suppressed by the more normal conditions of social interaction and sensory input. Elijah expresses great frustration and hopelessness believing that his attempts to remain faithful have resulted in nothing but disaster. And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. 1 Kings 19:10. God says to him, go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. 1 Kings 19:11 to 12. There are many famous phrases in the Bible, and a still, small voice is certainly one of them. It is at this moment that Elijah, and through him, mankind, comes to understand that God is not in the wind, no matter its ferocity, nor in the earthquake, regardless of its magnitude, but is something within, the voice of conscience itself, the internal guide to what is right and wrong, that autonomous spirit that resides in each soul and shames us before ourselves, draws attention to our shortcomings and sins, and generates the impulse to repent, apologize, and atone. This is a discovery of unparalleled magnitude. The possibility of establishing a relationship with God by attending to conscience. God grants man and woman free will, even though he wants the allegiance of his created creatures and also wishes to guide them. How can he best manage to reconcile these competing desires? Not by command, force, or fear, but by the provision of a voice, an image, or even a feeling that can nudge and suggest or shame and humiliate quietly and softly, even though it is capable of magnifying its intensity when necessary. This identifying of conscience with God is made increasingly explicit within at least certain streams of Christian thinking. The 19th century British theologian Cardinal Newman, for example, insisted on exactly that in much of his writing. The divine law, then, is the rule of ethical truth, the standard of right and wrong, a sovereign, irreversible, absolute authority in the presence of men and angels. The eternal law, says St. Augustine, is the divine reason or will of God, commanding the observance, forbidding the disturbance of the natural order of things. The natural law, says St. Thomas, is an impression of the divine light in us, a participation of the eternal law in the rational creature. This law, as apprehended in the minds of individual men, is called conscience, and though it may suffer refraction in passing into the intellectual medium of each, it is not therefore so affected as to lose its character of being the divine law, but still has, as such, the prerogative of commanding obedience. This can well be considered a more powerful and justified argument than the now much more frequently used argument from design, the insistence that the complexity of nature necessarily indicates an active creator. The book of Elijah lays the revelatory groundwork for a much more psychological and relational definition of the supreme deity, detaching God from the pagan theater of the natural world, awe-inspiring as nature might indeed be, and placing him wonderfully and terribly inside us all. It is Elijah's realization that sets the stage for the account of Jonah as well, for the mysterious tale of the prophet who first rejects and then obeys the call of the still small voice and whose exploits constitute the story that closes this volume. The fundamental and revolutionary importance of Elijah's contribution is signified by the miracle of his living ascent into heaven. This event, prefiguring Christ's resurrection and Jonah's own in its way, indicates Elijah's unparalleled success as a prophet. The biblical texts and their characterization of God simply cannot be understood in the absence of appreciation for Elijah's unparalleled significance as a prophet and for the vital importance of his transformative and revolutionary realization. After encountering the story of Elijah, we perceive the nature of being, ours and that of the divine, differently, more clearly, and more directly and personally. Our eyes are opened, and we can hear in a new way. Why, once again, the story as the foundation, even for the act of perception itself, or even more profoundly, as we can be radically changed by a sufficiently deep narrative, for the transformation of the act of perception itself. Because the world has to be filtered through the mechanism of story to become comprehensible or even apprehensible. That story might merely be one of the foolishness of our momentary whim when we are or have remained infantile or childish and oriented toward the immediate gratification of our desires. It might be our desire instead to obtain the power that makes such gratification possible, despite the presence or even objections of the others we are forced to contend with as we navigate forward. It might instead be mature establishment of the ties that bind and give true meaning to our lives, the ties of marriage, family, friendship, trade, and state. Perhaps as well, it is the harmonious and productive integration of present and future in the autonomous individual that makes up true maturity and responsible conduct, both cooperative and competitive. It is the latter form of stories that are eternally the truest, most reliable, meaningful, uniting, comforting, inspiring, and unifying. We wait the facts we encounter as we must wait them, so that we can discriminate them from absolutely everything else. Some things have to be prioritized for us to perceive anything at all against the blooming, buzzing confusion that would otherwise prevail. Such prioritization is a process indistinguishable from that of valuing and that of lifting up, celebrating, even worshiping. We elevate some pathways forward, things in the world and people, to a higher place than others, consigning everything deemed lesser to the netherworld of impediment, obstacle, enemy, or foe, or to the invisible domain of irrelevance. Thus, we order, simplify, and reduce the world, prior even to its conscious perception. This prioritizing is by no means a merely passive process. It is instead an active selection and simultaneously ignoring, an act of giving up, offering, or sacrifice. We are not the submissive receivers of simply self-evident truths, of the simple and self-evident facts. Every perception is an effort as much as it is a sensation. Every perception requires the movement of eyes, the inquiry of fingers, or the direction of hearing. Everything we experience is irreducibly dependent upon motivation and action instead of automatically or reflexively sensory, with sensation therefore never occurring simply prior to action. Whatever occupies our attention, whatever we are conscious of, however briefly, is thus something elevated for the moment to the highest place, the place of the divine, by definition. Whether we know it or not, we must specify what is most valuable currently and not anything and everything else, even to see. Those elements of momentary, even pinpoint attention, are in turn themselves organized more or less coherently, depending on the degree of our integrity, into a pyramidal structure of worth. That structure, moreover, is either one with something at the top, our ultimate aim, or is the house divided against itself that cannot stand. Mark 3:25. We see the world through a hierarchy of value. This is the map we use to guide our navigation through the unknown territory in which we would otherwise be lost. We perceive, therefore, in accordance with our aim. That is a remarkable and insufficiently heralded realization, implying as it does nothing less than that both our misery and our joy depend on our values. We elevate what we regard most highly to the utmost place of supremacy or sovereignty. We aim, however momentarily, at the upward target we deem central. We bring our consciousness itself to bear on what we define as worthy of the expenditure of our attention and the efforts of our action. We begin our continual journey forward by positing a good that is at least better than our point of departure. This is an act of faith as well as one of sacrifice. Faith, because the good could be elsewhere. Sacrifice, because in the pursuit of any particular good, we determine to forego all others. All our perceptions, consequent to such elevation, are allies, spiritual partners of our first and determining decision. That aim delineates around us a moral landscape with the destination we strive toward, serving as the highest imaginable good, at least for the time and place given relevance by our intent. Aim thereby provides the world with its point, prioritizing and organizing even its perception. In consequence, we see laid before us the pathway forward, the route we perceive as most likely to lead us to where we have determined to go. We see what and who impedes our movement forward and despair. We see what and who aids us and hope. Much of our communication and almost all of our dramatization is the description, imaginative portrayal, or embodied example of aim. We show and tell other people what we're up to, and we expect and want them to show and tell us the same. We talk amongst ourselves, shallowly or seriously, about just exactly what those we know are up to. What do they want? To what do they attend? How are they acting in consequence? We begin to speak of character rather than immediacy of aim when we speak more deeply of such things, as character is nothing more or less than the habitual embodiment of aim. To know ourselves or others, that is to understand character. How do we go about acquiring and representing such knowledge? We act out, imitate, perform, dramatize, so we can represent and internalize the patterns of attention and action that characterize ourselves and other people. When we describe the aims of a person or a people, their pathway forward, the obstacles and opportunities that emerge on that journey, the friends and foes that accompany their movement, the moral landscape that emerges, we tell stories. Stories reveal to us in their characterizations the structures of worth within which the world manifests itself to our perception, understanding, and identification. Why does this matter? What does it signify? Why is it important, even vital? Because it is a terrible challenge to see and act in the world in all its incomprehensible complexity. We become engrossed, even despite ourselves, in the stories we act out as children, that we observe on the stage or movie screen or read in the works of fiction, even as adults, because there is nothing we need to know more than how to construct, adjust, and improve the hierarchy of value within which the relevant facts of the world realize themselves. That is how we come to construct the world we occupy existentially. That is how we navigate forward and how we decide where forward itself lies. Thus, we value descriptions of how to perceive and behave, and perhaps more highly than we value anything else. That valuing speaks both to the difficulty of perception and to the necessity of story. A story is the description of the structure that furnishes the world with its objects, its relevant objects, dividing the world into up and down, good and bad, or even good and evil, ally and enemy. The revelation of character, that is drama, the world of literature and fiction. The plot, the adventure through the landscape, is the unfolding of character in keeping with its aim. We watch the hero aiming upward, living in truth, sacrificing for what is better, struggling nobly against the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, yet maintaining his integrity. We observe the objects of the world revealing themselves to him as the tools and obstacles relevant to his journey. We watch the friends he meets along the way perform the sacrifices necessary to be of aid and are pleased to see it. We watch his foes cheat, steal, betray, lie, and fail, and feel that justice has been served. Or we watch them succeed and experience the moral outrage of the deceived. We see him finally transform and develop in a revolutionary manner when he encounters the magical events or beings from another world, playing by different rules, hence the magic, who change his very aim, providing him with a new and expanded identity if the transformation is upward, or casting an evil charm over him if they tempt down. We adopt the goals of those whose tales entrance us. We aim at what they aim at, see what they see, experience the emotions they experience, and learn the lessons they learn while safely ensconced in the imaginary world. That is the value of the fictional. It is the realm of experiment in value. It is the abstracted world where the play that shapes our very perceptions can manifest itself most safely and effectively. We place what we most value, the good whose discovery is our purpose, the destination that is the target of the moment, at the top, at the pinnacle, in the place of supremacy or sovereignty. We aim at the target we deem central, however momentarily. We focus on what we define as worthy of the expenditure of our attention and the efforts of our action. We posit a good, at least a good that is better than our point of departure. This is an act of faith as well as sacrifice. Faith, because the good could be elsewhere, and sacrifice, because in the pursuit of that good, we determine not to pursue all others. Every perception is aligned with that initial and determining faith, while the decision that establishes the interpretive frame is itself a partial voyage toward the promised land of our aim, dependent as such perception is on action, which is the very constituent element of voyage. Our aim delineates around us a moral landscape, with the aim serving as the highest imaginable good, at least for the time and place made relevant by that aim. Aim gives the world its point, prioritizing and organizing even its perception. We see laid before us, in consequence of that aim, the pathway forward, the route we perceive as most likely to lead us to where we have determined to go. We see character as well as aim embodied as the habitual pursuit of aim. That is the point of someone's action. All this observation, this definition, gives rise to some crucially important questions. If we do and must see the world through a story, if the world reveals itself to us in the form of a story, what is that story? Equally, Or even more importantly, what should it be? What is the appropriate hierarchy of value through which the world most productively, generously, and sustainably reveals itself? What is relevant and what can and should be ignored? To what should we devote our costly attention? How do we properly characterize our aims, our most profound temptations, our most admirable upward strivings? To what ends should we aim our action? What, in other words, is the story, the true story of our lives? It is and must be an account of our highest aspirations, our most fundamental relationship, and simultaneously of the true ground under our feet. It is, therefore, and must be, the characterization of the divine itself, of God, just as the biblical accounts insist. And this, by definition. And what is that divinity, that God? In the story of Elijah, God is portrayed as the subtle promptings of conscience. Important as it is, central as it is to the current story, it is by no means the only manner in which God makes himself manifest, is not his only dramatic persona. God appears as calling in another of his primary guises, as inspiration, aspiration, adventure, enthusiasm, curiosity, even temptation, and also as much more. We most profoundly wish to meet, and if possible, to become the hero, for example, another guise related intrinsically to conscience and calling, and not just the hero, but the hero of all heroes. We want to take on the mien not only of the king, master of his domain, but of the king of kings. We are constituted so that we admire the divine principle of sovereignty itself. We desire to take on the perspective of the spirit properly put in the highest of places and experience the world through his eyes. We want to do this so that we can adopt the stance of heroism and responsible kingship toward the problems that both beset us terribly and offer us endless opportunity. We want to understand as profoundly as we are able the nature of the good that stands behind all proximal goods, the good who brings about the compelling life more abundant that is the true garden of eternal desire. We want to identify, likewise, the villain who stands behind all acts of villainy, the nature of the spirit who wishes to produce all the suffering of the world for the sake of nothing but all that suffering. We want to understand good so that we can be good and understand evil so that we can avoid being evil. In this way, we can bring about the salvation and redemption of the world in small ways and great. In this way, we can constrain the hell that evil produces, and not just for ourselves, but for everyone we care for and love, for the stability and continuance of the societies that we inhabit, and for the love of the world itself. For better or worse, the story is the thing. For better or worse, the story on which our Western psyches and cultures are now somewhat fragilely founded is fundamentally that which is told in the library of the Bible. That is the tremendous compilation of drama that sits at the base of our culture through which we look at the world. This is the story on which Western civilization is predicated. It is a collection of characterizations, not only of God, whose imitation, worship, or indeed embodiment is held to be the highest of all possible aims, but of man and woman, whose characters are held to exist in relationship to that God, and of society, in relationship to the individual and the divine. It is as well the revelation of the sacrifice that makes such aim possible, and an examination in dramatic form of the transcendent target that is held to unite all things in the best possible manner. The biblical story, in its totality, is the frame through which the world of facts reveals itself, insofar as the West itself is concerned. It is the description of the hierarchy of value within which even science itself, that is, the science that ultimately pursues the good, is made possible. The Bible is the library of stories on which the most productive, freest, and most stable and peaceful societies the world has ever known are predicated. The foundation of the West, plain and simple. The landscape of the fictional is the world of good and evil, the world of value, with its pinnacle ever receding into the promised land itself, and the eternal pit of abysmal and infinite suffering occupying the lowest of possible places. The biblical stories illuminate the eternal path forward up the holy mountain to the heavenly city, while simultaneously warning of the apocalyptic dangers lurking in the deviant, the marginal, the monstrous, the sinful, the unholy, the serpentine, and the positively demonic. God, in this formulation, is the spirit that leads up. Man is the being who struggles with that spirit with every decision, because a decision is a matter of prioritization. With every glance, as every glance is a sacrifice of possibility towards some desired end, and with every action, as he moves towards some destination and away from all others. At every moment of consciousness, we are fated to wrestle with God. Chapter 1, In the Beginning, 1.1, God as Creative Spirit. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Genesis 1:1-2. How is God presented as the great book of Genesis begins? As an animated spirit, creative, mobile, and active, something that does and is. God is, in short, a character whose personality reveals itself as the biblical story proceeds. Genesis opens with a confrontation. God is moving upon the face of the waters. What does moving mean? It means God is mobile, obviously. Less obviously, moving is what we say when we have been struck by something deep. God is what has encountered us when new possibilities emerge and take shape. God is what we encounter when we're moved to the depths. What then does waters mean, particularly the waters that God has not yet created? That is the ancient Hebrew teom or tohu vabohu, chaos, potential, what lurks but has not yet been revealed, as water is the precondition for life but also harbors the unknown in its depths. God is therefore the spirit who faces chaos, who confronts the void, the deep, who voluntarily shapes what has not yet been realized and navigates the ever-transforming horizon of the future. God is the spirit who engenders the opposites, light and darkness, earth and water, as well as the possibilities that emerge from the space between them. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. And God said, "Let the waters under the heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called the seas. And God saw that it was good. Genesis 1:6-10. And God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs, and for seasons, and for days, and years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth." And it was so. Genesis 1:14-15.
How might we, in human terms, understand this first encounter with God? What is he? And what is he confronting? Imagine for a moment what you face when you awaken in the morning. Your attention does not seize on the objects that surround you, on the banal reality of your bedroom furniture. Instead, you ruminate on the challenges and opportunities of the day. Perhaps you feel anxious because there are simply too many things to deal with. Maybe, hopefully, you are in a better situation, and you look forward instead to the opportunities that present themselves. Your consciousness, your being, hovers over the potential offered to you by the new beginning of the morning in a manner akin to the conditions and process of creation itself, as portrayed in the opening verses of the Bible, a creation that continues with every glance you take and every word you utter. Through consciousness, we process the domain of possible being, of becoming. That is the realm that inspires both hope in our apprehension of positive things ahead and anxiety in the face of life's dreadful uncertainty. Here is another way of understanding our confrontation with possibility. Imagine any object. Now imagine that there's a space surrounding that object, consisting of what that object could become as time progresses and context shifts. Under normal conditions, the most likely future state of any familiar object, a bottle, a pen, the sun, can be predicted by its current state. With a vicious twist of fate, however, or a radical shift of aim, such constraints can be lifted, and the object's unrevealed possibility made apparent. A bottle in a raucous bar can become a deadly club, or smashed in anger, a spear with the edges of a razor. A pen can become the mechanism of life itself when inserted into the trachea of someone choking. The sun can become not the stable and predictable giver of life and light that defines the days and nights we inhabit, but the source of the solar storm that brings down the electrical grid on which we so fragilely depend. It is that breadth of possibility that consciousness confronts and processes when it apprehends the world and determines to act on it. Our movement forward in time is therefore no mechanical procession through a realm of stable actuality. Consciousness deals with what could yet realize itself in exactly the same way the Spirit of God deals with the void and formless deep, in the way the divine contends with the massa confusa that is chaos and opportunity and the matrix from which all forms emerge. God is equally that which or who creates not only order, but as is stressed repeatedly throughout the opening book of the biblical corpus, the order that is good. On the first day, he establishes the separation between light and darkness, Genesis 1:3-4. On the second, he creates the dome of heaven, separating the lower waters, the terrestrial, and the upper waters, the source of rain, Genesis 1:6-8. On the third, the terra firma we inhabit is gathered together and separated from what then becomes the oceans, and plants appear on the ground, Genesis 1:9-13. On the fourth day, God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also, and God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, Genesis 1:16-18. On the fifth day, the fish and birds appear, Genesis 1:20-23. All this creation, despite its pristine quality or goodness, is still striving upward, developing further, as indicated on the sixth and last day of God's calling forth of the world. The animals make their appearance, Genesis 1:24-25. And finally, man and woman. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. Genesis 1, 26 to 28. In this finale of creation, God seems to have extended himself beyond anything he managed previously. He renders the following judgment. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Genesis 1, 31. What does this mean? It means, in the first place, that God not only confronts and shapes chaos and possibility, but does so with benevolent intent and positive outcome. God is presented as the process or spirit, guided by the aim of having all things exist and flourish, the spirit guided by love, in a word. This sequence of creation means, in the second place, not only that life should and will manifest itself more abundantly, but also that it will do so in the constant upward spiral from good to very good that might serve as the definition of heaven itself. That is Jacob's ladder, the process that is eternally making everything as it should be, but is somehow also improving, finding new pathways to higher orders of the true, the beautiful, and the good. Creation culminates in the making of man and woman, and it is their creation specifically that is deemed very good. The first two human beings, and men and women in general, are thus avatars of God himself, with God as the creative spirit that calls order into being from chaos and possibility, and man and woman as a microcosm of that spirit, similar or even identical in essence, charged with forever reiterating the creative process. A more optimistic conception of humanity could hardly be imagined. Nor could the importance of God's insistence be greater. This description of creative process, portrayal of the action of the Word oriented to the good, is also a statement of first principles, the very principles that man and woman are immediately called upon to submit to and uphold. The biblical account ascribes to each of us a value that places us at the very pinnacle of creation, a value that is very good in a cosmos that is good, a value that supersedes all earthly evaluation, given our reflection of the image of the divine itself. This, it must be understood, is a matter of definition. The stake in the ground around which everything else must rotate is established upon humanity's divine reflection, and it is to be held as immovable, sacrosanct, inviolable, sacred. This is nothing less than the description of the moral order implicit in the cosmos itself, reflective of the nature of God, man and woman, and the foundation upon which the idea of intrinsic rights and sovereign responsibility is based. Do we believe this story? Do we believe what it states and implies? First, what does it mean to believe? We certainly act individually and collectively as if it were true, at least when we are behaving as we should, at least when we are acting in the genuinely best interests of ourselves and everyone else. We treat the people we love, and even the people we hate, as if they are indefinitely valuable loci of creative consciousness, capable of finding their way forward and creating the world that is dependent on their finding. It is the fact of this supreme identity and being that forever impedes the power-mad striving of every organization, society, or state that dares threaten individual sovereignty. The wise and the unwise alike would do well to thank the Lord for that. We object, deeply offended, if anyone fails to treat us as befits a child of God. That is, if anyone fails to treat us as if we truly matter. We likewise offend if we treat others as if they are beneath us, as if they are anything less than the conscious beings of sacred worth, upon whose experience reality itself somehow mysteriously depends, even if the story that we tell ourselves in this increasingly atheist, materialist, and fact-based world exists in skeptical contradistinction to that belief, we still believe, insofar as we act out such offense, whether given or taken. No man who avows disbelief in free will or even in consciousness itself dares to treat his wife as if she lacks free will or consciousness. Why not? Because all hell breaks loose if he does. And why is that? Because the presumption of intrinsic value reflects a reality that is deep enough, real enough, so that we deny it at our practical peril. And if that presumption is so absolutely necessary,